It was our hope during
Enrico
the war
Fermi of Italy, Nobel Prize winner, famous for creating the world's first nuclear chain reaction.
One of the things that I shall not forget.
Arthur Holly Compton of the United States, Nobel Prize winner, famous for his discoveries about electrons and cosmic rays.
If I had the good fortune to
Niels Bohr of Denmark, Nobel Prize winner, famous for his insights into the structure of atoms. Otto Hahn of Germany, Nobel Prize winner, famous for his discovery of nuclear fission. The list continues. Einstein of Germany, Curie and Joliot of France, Meitner and Frisch of Austria, Wheeler and Alvarez of the United States. Most of them winners of the Nobel Prize. All of them superb scientists. An international community joined in an effort to answer an ancient question: how does matter behave? A community that in 1939 came to focus on one narrow question: what happens to a uranium atom when a neutron hits it? In the tape you are listening to, you will hear these illustrious men and women describe the historic events which brought them to understand nuclear fission. You will not be listening to actors, but to the people who actually made history. This is a first-person account. It is not a physics lesson. You should not expect to learn all about the physics of nuclear fission. What you can expect is a better understanding of how science is done. This tape gives a glimpse into the scientific process, the lives of some renowned individuals involved in that process, their role in solving a particular problem. As you listen, you will hear them describe themselves, their frustrations, their successes, their prejudices, their worldview. They tell of how they related to science as human beings. Can atoms be split apart? Does each atom have inner workings? Parts which can be separated? Parts which can perhaps be put to some use? These questions had already come to mind in 1898 when J.J. Thomson isolated the electron. That was the first solid proof that atoms are indeed built of much tinier pieces. Thomson speaks of the electron in this recorded passage.
Could anything at first sight seem more impractical than a body which is so small that its mass is an insignificant fraction of the mass of an atom of hydrogen, which itself is so small that a crowd of these atoms, equal in number to the population of the whole world, would be too small to have been detected by any means then known to science.
Ideas about the atom were refined by one of Thomson's students, Ernest Rutherford. He showed that the mass in an atom is not smeared out uniformly throughout the atom, but is concentrated in a tiny inner kernel, the nucleus. Rutherford wanted to understand the nucleus, not for any practical purpose, but because he was attracted to the beauty of its simplicity. Fundamental things should be simple, not complex. Here is how he explains himself in 1931.
The bother is that a nucleus, as you know, is a very small thing, and we know very little about it. Now, I had the opinion for a long time, that's a personal conviction, that if we knew more about the nucleus, we'd find it was a much simpler thing than we supposed. That these fundamental things, I think, have got to be fairly simple. But it's the non-fundamental things that are very complex, usually. I am always a believer in simplicity, being a simple person myself.
A young man working with Rutherford in 1911 was Niels Bohr. They created a halfway successful model of the atom called the Rutherford-Bohr model. They imagined a nucleus at the center with electrons orbiting around it. 25 years later, Bohr described his collaboration with Rutherford.
If 25 years ago I had the good fortune to give a modest contribution to this development, it was above all thanks to the hospitality I then, as a young man, enjoyed in the famous laboratories of England. In particular, I think with grateful emotion of the unique friendliness and straightforwardness with which Rutherford, in the midst of his unceasing creative activity, was always prepared to listen to any student behind whose youthful inexperience he perceived a serious interest.
To Bohr, studying the atom was a friendly pursuit of truth. The public was not so sure. Rutherford and other scientists had already happened to notice that energy is intensely concentrated within the nucleus. Newspapers began to talk about the chances of unlocking that energy. Reporters said atoms might run the world's industry someday, after our supply of coal and oil ran out. On the other hand, H.G. Wells wrote a novel featuring atomic bombs. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch in 1903 describes atomic energy.
The most wonderful and mysterious force in the universe, the atom's power, will be inconceivable. It could revolutionize the illumination system of the world. It could make war impossible. It is even possible that an instrument might be invented which at the touch of a key would blow up the whole earth and bring about the end of the world.
Most physicists ignored that sort of wild journalism. All they wanted was to get a better picture of the nucleus. One big step came in 1932 when Cockcroft and Walton, in Rutherford's laboratory, built a machine that could shoot a beam of protons at very high speeds. They fired protons, like bullets, into metal targets. The collisions transformed some of the nuclei in the target atoms. Some of the atoms' mass was converted into energy. This Cockcroft-Walton experiment demonstrated for the first time a concept that Albert Einstein had proposed almost 30 years earlier. He had theorized that energy and mass are equivalent. They can be converted into one another. Let's hear Einstein tell about it.
It followed from the special theory of relativity that mass and energy are different manifestations of the same thing, a somewhat unfamiliar conception for the average mind. Furthermore, the equation E is equal mc squared, in which energy is put equal to mass multiplied with the square of the velocity of light, showed that very small amount of mass may be converted into a very large amount of energy, and vice versa. The mass and energy were in fact equivalent, according to the formula mentioned above. This was demonstrated by Cockcroft and Walton in 1932 experimentally.
The New York Times reacted to experiments like those by Cockcroft and Walton with enthusiasm.
Science has obtained conclusive proof from recent experiments that the innermost citadel of matter, the nucleus of the atom, can be smashed, yielding tremendous amounts of energy and probably vast new stores of gold, radium, and other valuable minerals.
But the Cockcroft-Walton work, and every other nuclear physics experiment during the 30s, used up far more energy than it released. So physicists doubted that nuclear energy could be put to practical use anytime soon, if ever. Rutherford made this opinion public in 1933 at a scientific meeting, and his remarks were published in the scientific journal Nature.
These transformations of the atom are of extraordinary interest to scientists, but we cannot control atomic energy to an extent which would be of any value commercially, and I believe we are not likely ever to be able to do so. Our interest in the matter is purely scientific, and the experiments which are being carried out will help us to a better understanding of the structure of matter.
A few physicists were not so sure that nuclear energy could never be controlled. Leo Szilard thought of a possible way to do it. If he could find some sort of nucleus that would emit two neutrons whenever it was bombarded with one neutron, he might be able to set off a chain reaction. Szilard wanted to investigate various elements, including uranium. But he was not able to get money to do experiments. It was only in 1938 that many scientists began to focus their attention on uranium, the heaviest of known elements. Leading the pack were two German chemists, Otto Hahn and Fritz Strassmann. For over 30 years, Hahn had been working with another talented scientist, Lisa Meitner. However, Meitner was of Jewish ancestry and had to flee Nazi Germany. Otto Hahn recalls,
Miss Meitner, Professor Meitner, had left our laboratory on July 1938 on account of this Hitler regime things, and she had to go to Sweden. And Strassmann and myself, we had to work alone again, and in the autumn of 38, we found strange results.
Enrico Fermi had begun this line of work when he showed that neutrons work better than protons for penetrating and transforming a nucleus. By 1938, Hahn and Strassmann were among a number of scientists who were trying to find out what products are formed if you shoot neutrons into heavy elements. They hoped to find elements even heavier than uranium. Such altogether new elements would surely have scientific interest and perhaps even practical uses. But the substances Hahn and Strassmann produced looked like one or another of two known elements, which are chemically almost identical, either radium or barium.
We made precipitations, Strassmann and myself, where we could be absolutely sure that there could be nothing else but either radium or barium.
But physicists did not suppose a heavy element, like uranium, could be transformed into a light element, like barium. You might be able to knock off four protons from the nucleus of the uranium atom and create radium, but to get from uranium to barium, the neutron would have to chip off 100 particles. That seemed flatly impossible. Barium was out of the question.
Therefore, we could conclude that the substances could be really only radium, because barium was prohibited by the physicists. That we didn't dare to think at barium in those times. We always tried to explain what is wrong in our experiments. Not to say we will have barium, but we always thought it can't be there, and therefore we have to say what is the nonsense we are doing. You really, it is so. We poor chemists, is it the same with you? You poor chemists. We are so afraid of these physics people, you see.
Hahn wrote to Meitner in December of 1938, describing the strange results he and Strassmann had found. Meitner was equally baffled at first. Later that month, shortly before Christmas, her nephew, Otto Frisch, visited her in Sweden. Frisch was a physicist who worked at Niels Bohr's famous Institute for Theoretical Physics in Denmark. Years later, Frisch recalled his visit to Meitner in December of 1938.
Lise Meitner was in Sweden and was lonely, so I offered to come and visit her, and we met in the east, in the west of Sweden, in a small place near Göteborg. And when I came, she was brooding over a letter of Hahn.
And then we sort of kept rolling this thing around and saying, barium, I don't believe it, there's some mistake. You couldn't chip 100 particles off a nucleus in one blow. It's fantastic, it's quite impossible for a single neutron to do that. And I still don't know how we got to the concept of fission, but I remember Lise Meitner drawing a dotted circle on a piece of paper and saying, couldn't it be this sort of thing? Now, she always rather suffered from an inability to visualize things in three dimensions, whereas I had that ability quite well. And I had, in fact, apparently come around to the same idea, and I drew a shape like a circle squashed in at two opposite points. And Lise Meitner then said, well, yes, that is what I mean. Apparently she had, so to say, looked at the nucleus from the poles on, and with a dotted line was indicating the equator being pushed inwards.
Meitner and her nephew continued their discussion outdoors.
We walked up and down in the snow. I was wearing skis, and she said proudly she could get along just as fast on her feet, which she did. And gradually we came to the idea that perhaps one should not think of the nucleus being cleaved in half as with a chisel, but rather that perhaps there was something in Bohr's idea that the nucleus was like a liquid drop.
Now Meitner and Frisch understood what had happened in Hahn and Strassmann's experiment. The neutrons which they had shot into uranium had indeed been captured by the uranium nucleus. But then the nucleus changed shape, vibrated, came apart entirely. This was not the usual slight transformation of a nucleus. The picture did fit neatly with a recent theory of Niels Bohr's, A nucleus, he thought, behaves like a liquid drop. And a liquid drop, hit hard enough, might stretch until it broke in two. Now, if that happened to a nucleus, a lot of energy would be released. Atom for atom, far more energy than any process seen till then. Frisch continues the story of his visit.
I think I stayed there for about another day or so. We had Christmas dinner with some Swedish friends, and we discussed a few details. We agreed that we would have to write a paper about this, but we left it to be done separately somehow. It was eventually done in the way that I drafted the paper and read it out to Lisa Madner over the long-distance telephone between Copenhagen and Stockholm, and she would stop me and make comments and suggestions. So it was a slightly expensive way of writing a paper. My recollection is that when I came back to Copenhagen, I found Bohr just on the point of parting, of leaving for America, and I just managed to catch him for 5 minutes and tell him what we had done, and I hadn't spoken for half a minute when he struck his head with his fist and said, "Oh, what idiots we have been, that we haven't seen that before. Of course, this is exactly as it must be," and he added, "This is very beautiful, and had we written a paper?" And so I said, "No, we were in the process of writing one."
On his way to America by ocean liner, Bohr developed a more complete explanation of fission. He worked with a colleague, Leon Rosenfeld, who was making the trip with him. Rosenfeld later recalled their efforts.
When we met on the boat, he said, "I have in my pocket a paper that Frisch has given me, which contains a tremendous new discovery. But I don't yet understand it. We must look at it." Bohr accepted the conclusions because it was an argument directly following from the experiments. But he did not understand why the nucleus would split. And then, during the trip that took 6 days, I suppose, or so, he got hold of the solution. And it turned out to be extremely simple.
Meanwhile, back in Denmark, Frisch wanted to check by experiment the idea that uranium can split in two. Several methods could be used to study subatomic particles. The easiest was to look at electrical effects in an ionization chamber using an amplifier and oscilloscope. Invisible particles passing through the chamber would show up as pulses on the screen of the oscilloscope. The hallmark of fission would be the size of the pulses. The two halves of a split atom would have far greater energy than any known particle. Frisch describes his work.
I rigged up a pulse amplifier for the special purpose, and I also built a small ionization chamber, but that whole thing only took me about 2 days. And then I worked most of the night through to do the measurements because the counting rates were very low. But by 3 in the morning, I had the evidence of the big pulses. And I went to bed at 3 in the morning, and then at 7 in the morning, I was knocked out of bed by the postman who brought a telegram to say that my father had been released from concentration camp.
By this time, Frisch and Meitner had finished writing their joint paper in which they interpreted the Hahn-Strassmann results as nuclear fission. Frisch, meanwhile, wrote a second paper about his new experiments, which confirmed their guess.
They were both sent to Nature at the same day, but Nature published one after the other. And I might still mention that the word fission occurs in the first paper and was suggested to me by an American biologist, William A. Arnold, whom I asked what you call it when a cell divides itself.
On the same day that Frisch sent his two scientific papers on fission out for publication, January 16, 1939, Niels Bohr's ocean liner docked in New York. Enrico Fermi was on the pier to meet him. The Italian physicist had arrived in New York 2 weeks earlier. The fascist government had allowed him to leave Italy to personally accept the Nobel Prize in Stockholm. Fermi, whose wife was of Jewish ancestry, had decided not to return, but to take a post at Columbia University. The next day, Bohr came up to Columbia, and there he happened to run into Herbert Anderson, a physics graduate student. Anderson never forgot the meeting.
Bohr came to Columbia, and he was looking for Fermi. And as he walked into one of the laboratories, expecting to see Fermi there, he didn't find Fermi, but he found me. And although he didn't know who I was, he was so full of his news that he grabbed me by the shoulder and he said, "Listen, young man, I want to tell you about something that's very important that's recently happened in physics." Poor doesn't speak very loud. He whispers, you see. He has to get very close to you, and then he whispers in your ear. And then he said, "Let me tell you about the fission." And so, of course, I was overwhelmed by having such a great man pick me out of everybody and tell me, give me this news almost for the first time. And so he began to explain about fission and how about neutrons were captured and uranium and how the thing got excited and then came apart and released a lot of energy. Well, then he had to leave, and so he left.
Anderson went to Fermi's office to tell him that Bohr was looking for him, but Fermi had already heard the news. Anderson continues the story.
And Fermi said, "Oh," he says, "I know. Let me explain to you about fission." So he went to the board and he began to show me. But of course, Fermi was much more vivid and much clearer, and I could always understand them much better. And he was evidently very interested in this thing. I decided then and there that this is a very exciting subject, and just right, maybe I could get a thesis out of it, which is all all graduate students think about. I'd realized that Fermi had just arrived, and that although he had achieved considerable fame as a theoretical physicist, I somehow had the idea that, well, his first love was really experimental physics, and it seemed to me at the time that what he really needed was a laboratory, some equipment, and a good graduate student, and I had all three.
Anderson and Fermi made a sort of agreement.
I would teach him about Americanisms, and he would teach me physics, and I would lend him the apparatus, and we would work together. Well, you know, things weren't very hard to do in those days, so he says, "Why don't we, you know, get the electrode of your ionization chamber, put some uranium on it, and let's go down to the cyclotron, and let's see if we can see all this energy release." And so we got busy just that afternoon, but there was a meeting, theoretical physics meeting in Washington, the next day, and Fermi was supposed to go to that. And so he left, and I began to wonder what to do, and I remembered that Dunning was in, and I came to Dunning, and I said, "Why don't we see if we can see this fission?"
John Dunning was a physics professor who Anderson had been working with already. Dunning remembers.
I went up to the 13th floor and brought down one of the old standard standby neutron sources, the radon plus beryllium sources that had been used so much before. We put it next to the chamber with the containing the uranium, and in considerable excitement we saw with this, even this very weak source, about one big pulse, a huge pulse on the oscilloscope every minute. The rate, however, was so slow that I had doubts whether this was really real or whether it was maybe a bad electrical contact. So we had another device, and installing that right next to the chamber, the rate went up, according to my notes, to something like 7 or so with that device. Huge pulses. We finally quit about 11 p.m. My notebook contains this phrase: "Believe we have observed new phenomenon of far-reaching consequences."
Meanwhile, Bohr and Fermi went to the Theoretical Physics Conference in Washington, D.C. One physicist in close touch with Bohr was John Wheeler.
Bohr felt that he owed it as a responsibility to Frisch and Meitner that word of their work in progress and their concepts should not really be released until they had had the proper scientific opportunity to publish it. And it was not until the second day of the conference that an issue of Die Naturwissenschaften was handed to him, which had just come in, which had the work of Hahn and Strassmann. So then he could tell about it, and then, of course, everybody got started on the experiments.
Not only scientists, but also science reporters picked up the news. Across the continent, in Berkeley, California, physics professor Luis Alvarez was particularly interested to hear of the discovery.
I remember exactly how I heard about it. I was sitting in the barber chair in Stevens Union having my hair cut, reading the Chronicle. And on the second section, buried away someplace, was an announcement that some German chemists had found that the uranium atom split into two pieces when it was bombarded with neutrons. That's all there was to it. So I remember telling the barber to stop cutting my hair, and I got right out of the barber chair and ran as fast as I could up to the radiation laboratory. And my student, Phil Abelson, had been working very hard to try and find out what transuranium elements were produced when neutrons hit uranium. And he was so close to discovering fission that it was almost pitiful. I mean, he would have been there guaranteed in another few weeks. When I arrived panting from the Students' Union with my news about fission, and I played it kind of dramatically, I saw Phil there, and I said, "Phil, I've got something to tell you, but I want you to lie down first." And so he lay down on the table in the right alongside of the control room of the psychotron. "Phil, what you're looking for are not transuranium elements, but they're elements in the middle of the periodic table." I showed him what was in the chronicle, and of course he was terribly depressed.
Hahn and Strassmann's paper arrived in Paris at the laboratory of Frédéric Joliot. With his wife, Irène Curie, Joliot had made important nuclear discoveries. Lou Kowarski was in the laboratory and remembers Joliot's reaction to the paper.
"It was on the 16th of January, and Naturwissenschaften, the famous number, arrived in the morning mail. Joliot probably had his first glimpse of the Hahn and Strassmann article in my presence. And it was, of course, a bombshell."
Don't forget that Kowarski is describing Joliot's reaction to the Hahn-Strassmann experiments. The Paris group had not yet heard how Frisch and Meitner had explained the strange results in terms of uranium fission. But Joliot followed an almost identical path, as Kowarski explains.
"Immediately, everything was understood. For the next few days, nobody talked of anything else. Joliot immediately had the ideas about splitting of uranium atom in two. Then he designed his famous experiment, which is, I think, one of the most elegant experiments I know of in the history of science, and which he performed before my eyes. It was that simple. It took a few days. So here it was. Fission was proved as physical reality. They still didn't know that Frisch had already observed it two weeks before."
Within weeks, the whole world knew about fission. Speculation about the vast stores of energy in the nucleus prompted a New York Times editorial in February 1939.
The possibility of harnessing the energy of the atom crops up again. Rutherford and other distinguished physicists did their best in late years to discourage speculations on the subject, because bombardment was so inefficient that more energy was expended on the atom than ever came out of it. Now the picture has changed. Romancers have a legitimate excuse for returning to Wellesian utopias, where whole cities are illuminated by energy in a little matter.
As soon as they realized that atoms can be split, physicists began to talk over the possible consequences. John Dunning recalls.
"I well remember that on January 25th, 1939, there was a session at the faculty club around Columbia, around the lunch table. Bohr had been talking very enthusiastically about fission possibilities in Princeton. And it seemed clear that this had to be really got after. Immediately, the question arises, as an experimentalist, not a theorist, shouldn't there be secondary neutrons created or evaporated? If there were enough of these, then the long-sought-for key to a self-sustaining nuclear energy release might indeed be here. World War II was pretty clearly in the offing at that time, and all of us recognized the far-reaching consequences that might be possible if fission could really be developed."
Being able to split uranium did not necessarily mean you could get a chain reaction and release a lot of energy. That question had to be answered before anything else. It was exactly the question that Leo Szilard had been asking for years. Now Szilard was in New York, another refugee from fascism, and he was urging people to attack the problem. Herbert Anderson recalls.
"Well, Fermi came back, and first thing he did when he came back to Columbia is he got a hold of me, took me in the office, and then began to write down on the blackboard all the experiments we ought to do. And of course, the thing that was the most important, if you were going to make a chain reaction, is to make sure that neutrons come out. Of course, so far, all that was known is that a lot of energy is released, but Szilard had already pointed out that to make a chain reaction, you had to have more neutrons emitted than were absorbed. But of course, Fermi realized that the two fragments of the fission would be very heavily neutron-rich, and it was quite likely that there would be some extra neutrons boiled off in the process. And so he immediately designed an experiment, which he wanted me to do with him, to see whether neutrons were emitted. And so we launched on a career of trying, first of all, to see whether neutrons were emitted and in what number. Experiments were also being done. In fact, they always seemed to be about a week or so ahead of us, by Joliot, Halban, and Kowarski, in working in Paris.
The Paris team, like Fermi, knew that a chain reaction would come only on one condition: if each uranium atom, when it split, spat out fresh neutrons. Joliot asked Kowarski to try to think of a way to detect them.
I went home for lunch, and here's one of those classical cases when scientists describe how they got ideas. I perfectly remember which place on what state it was that I had the idea. The idea seems so stupidly simple. If you observe any neutrons of higher energy, that proves it. It's rather elementary.
The Paris and New York teams both found that neutrons do come out from split uranium atoms. Yes, a chain reaction was possible. Now the basic nuclear physics was in hand. Now people could begin to ponder what to do with it. Over 3 years later, beneath the bleachers of the football stadium at the University of Chicago, Fermi led a team of physicists who released the first chain reaction. The physicist in charge at Chicago was Arthur Holly Compton. Here is his description of this historical moment.
We entered the balcony at one end of the room. On the balcony, a dozen scientists were watching the instruments and handling the controls. Across the room was a large cubical pile of graphite and uranium blocks in which we hoped the atomic chain reaction would develop. Inserted into openings in this pile of blocks were control and safety rods. After a few preliminary tests, Fermi gave the order to withdraw the control rod another foot. We knew that that was going to be the real test. The Geiger counters registering the neutrons from the reactor began to click faster and faster, till their sound became a rattle. The reaction grew until there might be danger from the radiation up on the platform where we were standing. Throw in the safety rods, came Fermi's order. The rattle of the counters fell to a slow series of clicks. For the first time, atomic power had been released. It had been controlled and stopped. Somebody handed Fermi a bottle of Italian wine, and a little cheer went up. One of the things that I shall not forget is the expressions on the faces of some of the men. There was Fermi's face. One saw in him no sign of elation. The experiment had worked just as he had expected, and that was that. But I remember best of all the face of Crawford Greenwald. His eyes were shining. He had seen a miracle, and a miracle it was indeed, the dawn of a new age. As we walked back across the campus, he talked of his vision. Endless supplies of power to turn the wheels of industry, new research techniques that would enrich the life of man, vast new possibilities yet hidden.
Leo Szilard recalled.
There was a crowd there, and when they dispersed, and Fermi and I stayed there alone, Enrico Fermi and I remained, I shook hands with Fermi and I said that I thought this day would go down as a black day in the history of mankind. I was quite aware of the dangers, not because I am so wise, but because I have written a book written by H.G. Wells called The World Set Free. He wrote this before the First World War and described in it the development of atomic bombs and the war fought by atomic bombs. So I was aware of these things. But I was also aware of the fact that something had to be done if the Germans get the bomb before we have it. They had knowledge, they had the people to do it, and it would have forced us to surrender. If we didn't have bombs also, we had no choice. Always thought we had no choice.
Enrico Fermi, in 1952, summed up the feelings of all people today.
It was our hope during the war years that with the end of the war, the emphasis would be shifted from weapons to the development of these peaceful aims. Unfortunately, it appears that the end of the war really has not brought peace. We all hope, as time goes on, that it may become possible to devote more and more activity to peaceful purposes and less to the production of weapons.
This unit was prepared by the Center for History of Physics of the American Institute of Physics. Work was funded by the United States National Science Foundation, the Heinemann Foundation, the Friends of the Center for History of Physics, and the American Institute of Physics.